Welcome to the Ortho Joke Podcast, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. Join hosts Mohit Bhandari and Mark Swankowski as they discuss current topics and publications in the world of orthopedics and beyond.
Good morning, Mark. I have a big mug.
Oh my gosh.
Java today. Yes, I know. Here's what I did. I took the standard, cup and I just put it in to make it look a little bit more sophisticated today. So I have a very large, I guess it'd be a cappuccino mug. I don't know what this would be. It's big. It's big.
You almost need a shoulder sling for that, that cup.
I'm getting my reps in. Yes, for sure. I'm lifting this thing. It's pretty big.
five pound reps. So let me just ask. I saw that paper cup. That didn't look like the standard Tim Hortons cup.
Oh, well, you know why? And again, I get nothing from Tim Hortons, by the way.
And, right.
It's roll up the rim to win season. So you roll up the rim and you see if you've won, and I've won one coffee, but usually early on you get wins, and then they suck you into buying more, and then you don't win as much. Like, they really push out wins early. So you feel like you're on the right side of this game in the first 2 weeks, and then you don't win again.
So this is probably an AI-driven program that Tim Hortons.
Well, they have all kinds of things. I mean, like, they're selling you, like, on the, yeah, it's all kinds of cool things on this cup that I could win. I never will. But anyways, it's good. It is like, I'm a lifer with Tim Hortons, so I go every day, buy my cup.
Yeah, I understand. I just have the traditional. Oh,
I love it. But then I thought I would be a little bit more non-traditional and put it into a nice,
you've got the dual purpose of upper extremity strength and caffeination. That's smart. So what's on your mind this morning?
Well, today I'm going to start with a quote, Mark, and this comes out of an OE report, which was an original report that we did in June issue of 2024. And we entitled it Research Waste, the Unpublished Clinical Trial Results Ultimately, and the challenges with those. And here's the quote: medical studies that are invisible benefit neither patients nor science. They are research waste. Institutions that fail to ensure that clinical trial results are made public violate medical research ethics and betray the trust of trial participants. Let me just take a pause there, Mark, and get your take on that. Too much, not enough, or is it just right in terms of the way that's been balanced?
I think that's a very justified and defendable position, particularly when you take the perspective of a patient participating in a trial. And you and I have a lot of experience with that. And patients who agree to participate, they're as invested in the results as we are, and many times are undertaking more inconvenience than we are. So to not have those results be available to the research public so that better research can come out of it, that's not defensible ethically. So no, I don't think it's too strong at all.
And the efforts have been to say, well, at least at a minimum, we should be registering trials. And I know the journal has done it under your stewardship as well. Like, you had set a goal to make sure that trials are registered. And I think, despite the push literally over the last decade and, in many, many journal publishers agreeing that we should be doing this, it's interesting when you look at actual completion rates. So, for example, between 2% and 40% of all registered clinical trials have made their results public within 12 months from the study completion. So, yes, they get registered, but clearly you're seeing a minority generally actually providing the final outcomes for people. So, it's one thing if they get published. A lot of studies don't get published, but even the ones that don't get published, going back to the place where let's say clinicaltrials.gov, as one example, right? As one place, very few. And, the US is about 40%, but there are places much, much lower. In places in Sweden, for example, and again, these are just based on published norms, and this is all in the report. Some are around 2 to 20%. So it's pretty remarkable that there's a lot of information, not being told. And I'll give you another one that we often have this bias against, right? So, anytime you see an industry sponsor or you see industry authors on a trial, what's the first thing that you typically hear about that, Mark, like from your experience? Okay, let's say someone submits, with industry personnel as co-authors on a paper. What's the immediate bias for or against?
Yeah, well, it's secondary gain on the part of the authors that they're somehow involved with stock options or
right.
speakers fees or something like that is what comes to mind off the top.
Sure. And then but in principle, the idea that industry somehow is not as pure as an academic institution that is doing it without sort of the industry funding. So there's this perception that, and also there's a big perception, and rightly so, that industry trials tend to be more positive than negative. And there's probably a strong rationale for why that would happen. I'm curious to get your take on that. But research from the US also suggests that results reporting is better for industry-sponsored trials compared to non-industry-sponsored trials. The odds ratio is threefold, so three times more likely if an industry is your sponsor that you're going to end up reporting those trials, and for larger sponsors publishing more trials compared to smaller sponsors. So that was 11-fold. So if you have a multi-million dollar program funded by industry, invariably it's going to get reported. So we can argue about the research methods and the motives and all that stuff, but the reporting quality at the end of the day seems to be actually better with industry. Why do you think that might be? And I have my own thoughts on it, but you can imagine. Anyways, I'll let you tell me what you think.
Yeah, well, I think it's because you have well defined and funded support for the trial, not only with design but also in following patients and having data sheets be completely filled out, et cetera, et cetera. So I think a lot of the experience in orthopedics in the United States is individuals, and I certainly have tried them early in my career, trying to do RCTs without any source of funding. And that leads to a whole set of problems, including the inability to follow patients, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it makes complete sense that the greater the funding base and support base for a trial, the higher chances it's going to be reported either positively or a negative trial.
Yeah, and it's also interesting, like if you look at the Canadian data, it said in Canada, with results suggesting that industry-sponsored studies were more likely to adhere to three best practices, prospective registration, results reporting, and publishing the findings compared with an academia-led sponsor, 36 versus 5%. And again, I think part of it too is that there is higher visibility, I think, with some of the industry studies. If an industry, they didn't talk about this, but if an industry study is being used to submit for a regulatory, if it's a regulatory submission for an expansion of an indication or a new indication, absolutely the FDA mandates that you do this. So there's going to be much stricter rules on this. And I think the idea of, whether they're positive or negative and industry trials being more positive, I always look at it this way. Like, I'm sure you've been in these groups, and I've been in lots, where you'll sit around with a group of your colleagues and, someone will say, well, we should do this, or we should look at that, or one should do this. Hey, I've got this data set. And they'll find support, maybe be a resident, maybe a medical student or some other college, and they'll go and do the study. Yeah. In industry, I've sat around in those, and I suspect you have too. They're thinking about, we don't have the luxury of just, picking random thoughts what we have and just going forward. We have to pick the idea that we think has the strongest possibility of moving forward, or we're not going to have jobs next year. And that's being very extreme. But imagine if our academic group sat around saying, well, let's say I have one trial and my appointment rests on me having a thoughtful, careful study, I suspect we would rethink everything. I think if I didn't have the luxury of failing all the time, and failure was, it wasn't just a learning opportunity, but it would affect my career, my path. I can imagine, a big program of research with tens of millions of dollars going negative time after time, I think I would have a different perspective on the types of questions I might ask and the way I design my studies. I think that's what happens. I mean, my experience has been when I've watched some of our academic CROs at McMaster, the way they plan and design studies is very, very under a very different pressure than I've seen our, just literally across the next building, our academic colleagues designing a similar study. So it's very interesting from that perspective. And it's given me a little bit more appreciation for the stressors on both sides.
Right. I think that's a very important topic. And CROs are contract research organizations. That's what they do. That's their job. It's not like us who are surgeons who are interested in the question are willing to invest time and energy in it. But our main job is taking care of patients and educating and et cetera, et cetera. So when it's your job to design and conduct a trial, it definitely does provide focus, particularly when your job or your next project may be at risk. So I couldn't agree more.
So there was this, you know, whole storyline around, okay, you know, we're not getting studies, you know, reported 12-month reporting. They may have been done, they may not have been done, but then it led to this whole, you know, body of research that explores why research findings go unpublished. What might you think might be some of the reasons, Mark, that research findings are not going, are not making it to the public domain?
I suspect the biggest one in our field is incomplete enrollment or under enrollment enough to even have data that's reportable in any useful way. That's my guess is number one. And number two would be if the findings were not what the investigators thought were going to be the findings.
So number one was absolutely lack of enrollment. Number three was selective publication, which is just what you're talking about. And there's a couple others. So another one was just lack of awareness that you actually had to report your findings at 12 months. I mean, on clinicaltrials.gov, there's a thing that says, you know, once you register 12 months of completion, you're ethically and morally responsible to report your findings. I think people just don't know to do that. And they have it. And it literally took to report a couple of lines or why it didn't finish would be, I think, hugely helpful to those who are trying to understand it or designing their own studies going forward. But the one at number four, and it wasn't insignificant, was it was perceived just lack of time. Like the authors themselves just said, I never got around to it. I just do it. I have the data. I just haven't written it. I just haven't got around to it.
Well, I understand that. And I obviously counsel a lot of junior faculty people. And the issue there is, again, goes back to how we spend our time as orthopedic surgeon, clinician, researchers. We have other things that are pressing. The next case, tomorrow's list, the clinic, another research project you're actively collecting data on, et cetera. And you know the answer. You personally know the answer for the trial. So you've gotten the feedback.
Right.
And
right.
It is a painful act to sit down and slog through the submission and review process. There's very little joy until the end when you see it finally appear. But as I try to counsel my younger colleagues, it's the coin of the realm. It's what's the way we're measured in a large extent in academic institutions. And we have to undergo that painful last step. It's like training for a marathon. You don't train, you're going to fail, and you've got to put the time in, and you've got to slog through the effort of writing the manuscript, getting some feedback from colleagues, refining it, submitting it, going through the revisions, et cetera, et cetera. All very painful. And I think we at the journal are pretty aware of it and try to make it as easy as possible, but it's not exactly fun work.
Oh, no. And it's a real process, right? And they always say it's the last 5%, but sometimes that last 5% doesn't feel like 5%. It feels like a lot more, like just the amount of, you know, organizing and getting it done. It's an exciting time, but it's also one that you just have to block time to do it. But it's interesting you said that, you know, if you're running a marathon, you're training. Well, if you're going to run, let's say in this case, a randomized trial, I guess the analogous training would be the pilot study, Mark. You know, it's almost like, it might be like, maybe we should be testing the waters. You know, when you look at the reasons why some of these things fail, number one being, we just couldn't organize it. You know, we couldn't get the patients in, we couldn't organize it, we couldn't get quote our sample size, we didn't have the time. You know, there's a whole bunch of other issues around technical, patients weren't compliant and therefore we couldn't recruit. It goes on and on and on. The pilot study itself, you know, at least I think at NIH, it's important. I suspect, I'm not sure it's mandated at NIH, but at Canadian Institute of Health Research, it's, even if you're a seasoned group, they are going to expect that you have completed a pilot study before they would consider funding a defendant. We've just literally gone through this process right now with a fairly large trial. And I'm curious on your take on the value of a pilot study. And ultimately, you know, what do we do with those pilot studies? Because I think a majority of those don't get published. A majority of those don't get out into the public domain at all, unless there's specific areas. You don't usually hear about them coming out. You only hear 10 years later that the definitive is published.
Right. Well, I think it's an extremely important step. And I have had a practice of when counseling my junior colleagues who are designing trials that, you need a good basis for proposing the trial with retrospective data, a systematic review, usually survey data. You know, we've all done these things, but it's also helpful to just survey patients who are being treated for the same condition and documenting whether they would be willing to be randomized. And that's an important study. If you can collect information on 40 patients and 20 of them are willing to be randomized into a two treatment arms, that's important data for a submission. But as far as where the pilot studies go, I think there's definitely a place for publishing these pilot studies. Just like, as you know, for larger, more sophisticated trials, we're now publishing ahead the protocols, right, which has become an accepted practice. I don't see any reason why we can't have a similar step in publishing pilot data, which is extremely important for the success of particularly large trials.
Yeah, I mean, like if you look at any ultimately successful large trial and you look back in the history of that trial, the group would have at some point conducted a pilot. What happened to that pilot data? Who knows? But, you know, it is important. I think it helps in many ways. One is a pilot helps you really determine whether you can do the study. You know, there's that two types of things. And I'll use the analogy, although I don't run marathons, but I know there's people listening and I know you have done quite a bit of running in your past, Mark. When you're doing a pilot, the advice I always say is run it like we are running the trial. Like if it's going to be a multi-center trial, we need a multi-center pilot. And we have to believe that we are running the big trial with all of the bells and whistles and all the things we want to do versus just run it like, oh, it's a small little study. We'll just do it and we'll prove, quote, quote, and then we'll try to do the real trial. I imagine it's the same as you got to train for a marathon like you're running a marathon, I presume. You can't sit around, do a little bit and call it like you're training, right? You got to be all in, I presume.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. You can't run your training pace at 7 minute miles expecting to run 6 minute miles in the ultimate. You have to go all out in your training sessions.
Right.
I think it for the multi-center trials, which is so common in our field, it also successfully completing a pilot assures investigators that we can really pull this off and it's worth going all in on the big trial because we have enough experience now to know we can do it. So it does, I think, predict success of a trial for sure to get people to fully buy in to complete the pilot study.
And, you know, the thing that I try not to do is try not to base the comparisons of a pilot, which we know by design would be underpowered because it would be a pilot of a larger study, and trying to make any sense of the data rather than was it feasible? Like, you know, could we actually recruit the patients we want to recruit? You know, did we get the centers? Did we have any major compliance? Do we have any major serious adverse events that would be dangerous? Like, you know, just things that would stop us from even moving forward that we'd had or unintended. But as much as there's the allure to look at the two groups of 30 patients or whatever the numbers are and say, oh yeah, we think we have a signal. We have been wrong so many times. I've been wrong so many times on signals of small studies that it's not worth even thinking about it. And you power your study or you plan your study based on what you think would be a, you know, a patient important difference and, you know, and a clinically relevant outcome. And you make it as conservative as you can to try to get as many patients as you can, because you will invariably still have had too small of a study. It always seems that way, no matter how big it is. If you think you want 10,000, you'll realize you needed 15. If you needed 1,000, you realize you need 1,001, whatever. It always seems like you need one more than you actually recruit.
Yeah, I've seen you present on this issue many times using the sprint trial data, Ream versus tibial nails, and the timeline with where the outcome would have gone.
Incredible.
400 at 800, et cetera. So Yep, very important.
I'll tell you, in our flow trial, maybe I'll end on this one. I'll give you the last word for sure, but here, but on our flow trial, which is looking at, you know, fluid lavage of open wounds, and which you're looking at Castile soap solution. And yeah. In a 100-patient pilot, we were like, wow, this thing's working. It's like, you know, it's soap seems to decrease risk of infection, you know, within 24 months, within the 1 year period, sorry. Get to the overall definitive trial, which is 2,400 patients or so, soap is harmful. Actually, yeah. Opposite, right? It is completely switched. And again, it just goes back to the play of chance with small studies, few outcomes events, fragility, all the terms that you hear about, you know, but when you've lived them, you really do appreciate, you know, take it careful and go as big as you possibly can, realistically, you know, within your resources.
Statistics are real.
So true. Yeah. So on the issue of medical studies that are invisible, benefiting neither patients nor science, Mark, your verdict.
Well, we have to report results for the ethical reasons we discussed early on. But I will end in the plea as a former editor-in-chief of JBJS, send us your negative studies. Yeah. And I had an editorial when I was in your position on this very thing, because amongst other things that we've already discussed, it prevents someone else from doing a similar sort of work and subjecting other patients to an experience that's not going to benefit them or any other patient. So send us your negative trials. That's the way I'd like to end this discussion.
Lovely. On that note, thanks again, Mark. A lovely morning and a great discussion as usual.
Yeah. Cheers.
All right. Take care.